Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending on where you are. What fun it is to talk to Irish bestseller Catherine Ryan Howard again. Now, I will say, for those who are wondering where we were last week, Catherine showed up, and I, inexplicably, for the first time ever, forgot. I don't have any excuse. I do. I had just gotten my cast off, and I had a manicure on my mind after 5 weeks in a cast. And so I was having my nails done when I realized that I had forgotten Catherine. So I'm incredibly sorry. But
totally fine.
Lovely about it. And it reminded me that because best-selling book publication dates differ in the United States, generally it's on a Tuesday, although it's creeping back. But in the UK and Ireland, it's on Thursday. So as it all worked out, it was good.
Here
for
we
her.
Are.
That she had extra time. And anyway, our autograph books are due in at the store any moment. So here's how it looks in an advanced reading copy. Now, I have to say, Catherine, that part of the story takes place in the Wicklow Mountains, and you mentioned Powers Court. So I went to my phone because I've actually spent time at Powers Court. So here
is... That's so funny, Barbara, because I am just back from there. Two of my aunts are staying in the hotel there. And because I live nearby, I said, why don't I go and collect you and bring you to my apartment? And we had some tea, and I just dropped them back this afternoon. So I was just in Powers Court.
Well, considering where we are, I'm sorry that I probably can't screen this, but look how.
Is that the Japanese garden?
It is. Yeah. And it's so green and beautiful. We are having a saguaro death watch. The temperature here is so high that the.
What's the temperature today?
It's 100 I can't remember, but it's been 119 anyway.
Anything over 90 for me and I'm gone. Irish people do not do heat, so
no, I know you don't, and apparently neither does this cactus, because you know, who would have imagined that a cactus would actually be the victim of the heat? And so we have this giant swirl right outside the library. Part of it has already collapsed. And I'm waiting for this awful crash, which might, you know, roof tiles. And there we would go, losing. So this is a fountain, if I can do this correctly, at Powers.
Yep.
Anyway, it's a gorgeous 18th century? Is that right? Or is it 19th?
That sounds 18th century sounds right, but don't hold me to it.
Well, I'm not at all sure that it's not a bit later than that. But anyway, it is truly a famous Irish country house in the Wicklow Mountains, which are south of Dublin, slightly southeast. Would that be right?
South, I would say. South, yeah.
Right. Anyway, are gorgeous, and they're lovely drives and interesting places to stay. And Powers Court has a hotel, restaurant, you know, all that good stuff, and amazing gardens, which I'm happy to say in May of 2019, it was the last cruise that before the pandemic, it was especially beautiful. Why am I wriggling around here? I just can't seem to get, there we go. All right. So the trap is based on a real story, isn't it? Or real
well, event. I want to be very clear that the trap is entirely fictitious. And I don't really like saying inspired by, because inspired is a positive word. And, you know, we don't want to say that we're using real cases, but it was certainly a starting point for me, the real cases, which are the Vanishing Triangle, as we call them, that were 8 women in 5 years here in Ireland back in the 90s. And I can't overstate how unusual that was at the time. We had never had anything like it. And 30 years later, none of those women have been found, and not one person has been charged in connection with their disappearances. So for that to happen in a country the size of Ireland and in a small little area in Ireland is just absolutely crazy. And I was a teenager in the 90s, so I was just starting to pay attention to the headlines. And what was on the headlines? Women are literally vanishing off the face of the Irish earth, and no one is doing anything about it or can do anything about it. And so I think that was always in my head, especially because we don't have any answers. And I think part of writing crime fiction is that you can take mysteries and you can take injustices and you can take unsolved cases and you can kind of bring a certainty and you can bring answers and control in a fictional setting. And I think there was definitely a part of that. But I would say this book came from two places. That was one of them. And the other one was a novella called The Vanishing by Tim Krabbe, which was made into a movie. Two movies, actually. The Hollywood version stars Kiefer Sutherland and Jeff Bridges and Sandra Bullock, where a man's partner disappears and the obsession with trying to find out what happened to her completely overtakes the grief of the loss. And he plays a game with himself. He says, you know, if I was given two choices, number one, she's alive and well, but I can never know anything. Or number two, she's dead and I get every detail, I would go with she's dead, because he's just in a place where he has to know what happened. And I think those two things like came together and gave me the idea for The Trap.
You know, that is such a powerful compulsion. I just read a book by Mindy Mejia called To Catch a Storm, in which there is a character like that who is obsessed with finding a missing girl, and so obsessed that she haunts his dreams. And, you know, people begin to think he's a psychic or whatever. He just can't let it go.
Can't let it go. And, you know, you can understand, like, I genuinely can't even imagine how the families get through, you know, an hour of not knowing, let alone all these years. And I suppose the question I was asking is, like, how far would you go if you just had to know? And in The Trap, it's very difficult to talk about without giving away anything, but we can give away this much, which is that Lucy, whose sister went missing about a year ago when the novel begins, is actually playing bait. She's trying to get taken by the man who took her sister. I don't think she has a plan beyond that, but if she can just find out like who and where and what, like that might bring something to her. And so obsession has pushed her into a really irrational, like dark and dangerous place, because after a year she's no closer to finding out what happened to her sister.
Well, I mean, not only is it dark, dangerous, and irrational, but it's so random that the chances that she can entice the person, if there is such a person, and we don't know that, who took her sister, you know, it's so minuscule, the chance, that you think it would be terrible if she ends up dead or something entirely, you know, in a way that's irrelevant to what's happened to her sister.
Exactly. And this is one, you know, this is one of the things I kind of want readers to be thinking about as they read the book, and, you know, her desperation, but also leaving aside the missing sister, like the risks she is taking in the way that she's doing this, and the reality of, you know, being a woman out alone at night and, you know, someone offers you a ride. It's not as simple as to say, okay, I'll get in the car. Like, you just, you know, you don't know what awaits. And so certainly all of that was a really, I felt like, interesting thing for me to explore in this book.
It really is. You do have too. I don't want to say anything that will reveal it, but
well, I think we can say who's in the book. That's okay.
Well, that wasn't actually the point I was going to make. In the second Lincoln Lawyer, which originally the book by Michael Connelly was made into a movie with Matthew McConaughey called The Lincoln Lawyer. But now it's being televised with a different cast and all. And on the first of the TV ones, so not the original movie, but the first one, I had read the book and I apparently had forgotten, or maybe in the book, because you can't see it, it's not sensible, but there is a MacGuffin that goes all the way through the TV thing. And in the very last episode, you see it and you sit there and you think, oh my God, you know, there it was all this time. And you have the same thing in your book. Like, we can't talk about what it is. You do have that same thing. And I found that fascinating because, you know, one of the reasons I think people read crime fiction, or at least some people read it, is the challenge. You know, am I going to see what the author is doing before I get to the end and the author shows me what it's, or tells me what it's going to be? And I thought about that all the way through reading the book. I thought, is this going to be that thing? So just mentioning it. I thought it was very well done.
Thank you.
I was so horrified when I realized what Lucy was doing. I just could hardly believe it.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the only possible explanation for it is a form of obsession that is truly unhealthy and takes her beyond any sort
rational.
Anything rational, anything prudent. But I also thought it underlined the fact that nobody was helping her. I mean, she's really alone and nobody's paying any attention. The cops kind of, when an adult goes missing, it's an entirely different thing than when a child goes missing. And very often when you have, busy police departments and, actual crimes going on, ones that they know are actual crimes, it's hard to get, there's budgetary restraints, there's personnel restraints and all. And oftentimes the position of the police is, that this person went away voluntarily.
So, I think we have this idea that if we don't know where someone we love is and we call the police, there'll be search teams and there'll be helicopters and there'll be, canine teams and all this, but that is not the reality. And particularly when you have a missing person, so you don't have a body and you don't have any evidence that they've come to harm, they're just not where they're supposed to be and they haven't been in contact. There's really not that much that anyone can do beyond appealing to the public for information. And I think that's really where, and actually what's funny is that's a theme in the very first thriller I wrote as well, Distress Signals, where, Adam is looking for his girlfriend. That leads him in a totally different place to this one, but speaking of cruises, but anyway.
Right.
So, I wanted her to be in that place where, no one is helping her and she has exhausted every option. She exhausts her last couple of options, during the course of the book. And so she's in this place where the chances of what she's doing working are so small. And also, if it does work, if she finds the guy, that's even worse because now she's in danger and, maybe he's going to do something to her if there is indeed a guy who took her sister. And so, you can't write a novel about someone who is pushed by obsession into a place where they make really good decisions and everything works out. The obsession had to be destructive and it had to, I want readers to be screaming at the page saying, "What the hell are you doing?" Because she's not in her rational mind. She has been disassembled and taken over by this trauma. And she's just at the end of her rope and she's just doing whatever she can, even though she knows, I do think she knows on a level that it's absolutely a fool's errand and, so dangerous and so unlikely to work, but that's what desperate people do.
It is what desperate people do. And I think you captured it very well. Let's talk about the policewoman instead, because a more positive note here,
we can
talk about Angela. Angela really wants to, you tell it, she's your character.
Yeah, so Angela and I have a lot in common, I think, in that we go to bed every night with the best intentions. We're going to get up early. We're going to eat healthy. We're going to do some exercise. We're going to get our lives in order tomorrow. And then we wake up and we say, "I'll do it tomorrow." And we have a Starbucks for breakfast and we get the tram to work and everything. So Angela is not a guard, not a policewoman, because she failed her physical competency test to get into the Gardaí. So she's going to take it again. In the meantime, she's doing nothing about passing it. She's hasn't worked out or anything at all. But in the meantime, she's working as a civilian in the missing persons unit. So what fascinates me about Angela is that she has great instincts, but she doesn't have the training to make good decisions and to make responsible decisions yet. So I thought that was a really interesting character to have for me, just sitting at home writing her, that you have someone who one day will be a great detective, but that day is not today. And so how does she just use her smarts, in the meantime until she actually is a guard? And she kind of has a very reluctant mentor in Detective Denise Pope, who is basically the guard that Angela dreams of being. you know, a high flyer, a type A, like takes absolutely no crap off anyone. And so together they kind of start pulling on a thread that maybe shows the possibility that the official investigation hasn't been done right. Let's say that there's things, question marks over the official investigation.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are definitely holes in it. So what you hope is that these two things will converge, you know, Lucy and her insane quest may pry something loose. Meantime, over here, the two, you know, people in law enforcement will.
Yeah, or they'll figure out what's going on before Lucy is in real trouble. I mean, I think there was a part of me when I was writing it that was like, maybe that's what people will be hoping for, that they can go to Lucy and say, you can stop this in time. But of course, readers will just have to find out what happens. Yeah.
So, did you find it disquieting to write this book? I mean, was it, you know, this is an unusual investigation. It's not straightforward, and it has these rogue elements in it. So did you find it unnerving to write it?
No, like a lot of people have been asking, because of course I've been doing a lot of like press for this book, and a lot of people are asking me questions like, how do you look after yourself when you're writing about these dark things, and how do you sleep at night? And I'm like, fine, like it doesn't affect me at all. I think with this book, I was probably a bit nervous as to how readers were going to take it. But at this point, I have to acknowledge that like my books are never straightforward. There's always something, you know, subverting, or you know, you're never going to get a this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and then the case was solved. That's just not like how my books are. And I included an author's note about the real cases because I wanted people to understand that, like, you know, we don't write about the real world, like drama and crime novels and all that. Like, it's not supposed to be the real world, because the real world has a lot of boring stuff. Like I often say, if crime novels were realistic, you know, they'd just be people waiting for reports to come back and making phone calls and stuff. But I wanted that element of like, everything in real life is very messy. And as in the cases of the real women, like there's 8 of them, there's no evidence that they're connected to each other. And I think, like, if you talk to people, they'll tell you, oh, this is what happened to that person, but they can't prove it. And that guy is suspected of this with that woman, but they can't prove it. So just because a number of women have gone missing, we can't assume the same person is doing them all. And the question in the book is, have the Gardaí identified the right cases to connect? And so the answer to that question is not straightforward, and it is a bit messy, but that is how I feel like a real investigation like that would be and has been here in Ireland. So I think readers will be a little bit mad at me at some points, but, you know, I do think someone said to me last week, you know, when I got to the end of the book, like I was thinking about it for so long afterwards. And I think that's the best thing I could ask for from a reader, that when they get to the end of the book, they don't just close it and say, well, that's a novel I read. You know, it's lingering in their head and they're wondering, you know, what happened to that person and where's that person now? And that's like, I couldn't ask for more than that from readers. So hopefully people will enjoy it. Sounds like the wrong phrase in light of everything we've discussed, but yeah, I'm hoping they won't regret reading it. Let's put it that way.
So have you taken note of the Long Island killer and the, you know, the many, yeah, many women that disappeared and the many years of investigation, which they now believe, thanks to more modern forensics and so forth, they believe they have caught it. And it does turn out to be, if they're right, one person. One of the amazing questions, which is sort of a question in your book, if not all that obvious, is, you know, this guy had a wife and children and, you know, and a job. I mean, he had a firm and the whole bit. Didn't anybody sense it? You know, how did the people that lived with him not realize what was going on? And they show that, in fact, when most of the crimes were committed, then his wife and children weren't at home. They were on vacation, right. They were out of the country, whatever it is. And you think about this incredible dual life that, you know, if he is guilty, we haven't been to court yet, so I don't believe so, you know, I can't say that he is for sure, but, you know, what kind of person can do that? You know, what kind of a person can actually on the surface lead a normal life and then dive off into, you know, the abyss the way that he does? And they have to come up with some sort of, I don't know if it's a rationalization or they're just comfortable with two personalities, or I have no idea how it all works. But that's a question that arises in your book is, you know, if this is one person, and if Lucy is able to smoke him out, or the detectives can smoke him out and all, what kind of life would he be? Would he have been leading? You know, was he some weird guy that lived in a tree in, you know, the Wicklow Mountains and just descended, you know, like, or, you know, was he some sort of ordinary person that nobody would have paid any attention to? And if he was, well, what drove
we've him? Had, we've had a couple of real cases here in Ireland that I certainly like drew on. Okay. And one of them, I don't want to mention his name because in Ireland you cannot talk about things where there is legal action pending, and let's just be careful. So he was convicted of one murder, and when the Gardaí went to his house, like, his wife answered the door and his young children were there, and she had absolutely no idea. And this was someone who spent a lot of time on the internet, like, you know, planning and sort of befriending people. And what I heard is that the wife thought he was having an affair, but it never, of course, even entered her head that he was doing what he was doing. And then there was another case, a very famous case, where a man who many people suspect of committing other crimes, but he was only charged with an attempted rape and murder, I think. He was kind of caught in the act. He wasn't arrested at the scene. He fled and he went home and he got back into bed next to his pregnant wife. So this is a man who did things that are like beyond barbaric, and he had a family. Like, we don't, I know it's difficult for us to understand and it's difficult for me to understand, but the men who do things like this are normal men. They are all living lives that on the surface, like if you think of the Golden State Killer, like, you know, he had a family, you know, he held down jobs, he was friends with his neighbors, you know, they're not going around being, they're not wearing a sign that says, I'm very strange, I'm a killer. You know, I think that also is more terrifying than if they were identifiable as the kind of men they really are. And so I'm always much more interested in ordinary monsters. And, you know, the guy in my book, we get to hear from his first person narration. He's basically telling someone like everything that he's done. And he does have a sort of, I wouldn't say justification, but he has an explanation for it, because everyone is the hero of their own lives. And so no one is going around thinking this thing that I'm doing is wrong. They're thinking like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, and these are the reasons why, and I've justified it to myself. And so I think it wouldn't be realistic to write about a man who is locked up in a cabin in the mountains, you know, a sort of loner who all the neighbors are wary of, because that's just not the way it works in reality. And actually what was so interesting about the Long Island case when I was reading through it is that from what I understand, they believe that he used his own house. And in the trap, there is like one location where stuff happens. And I put that in there because I thought that's really the easiest way to get away with it, that you have one place and you say to yourself, you know, if this is ever discovered, I'm done for. There's forensics, there's stuff, you know. But until then, this is a place where I can take women, or I can do whatever it is I want to do. And so I thought it was interesting that seems to be the case.
That's kind of a safe house if you really think about it.
Yeah.
Right. How, you know, apparently there is some sort of predator thing they can overtake. How often, I'm trying to remember, do we ever read about women who, I mean, there are a few, but
very few.
Generally it's men, and when it's women, they're very often is a fully other thing where they are with some, you know, some like, you know, Myra Hinckley or whatever her name was, an example I always think of. But, you know, so, you know, is this like an X chromosome thing and a Y chromosome thing, you know, that that there's just some people go rogue?
I think women go rogue too, but I think they go rogue in very different ways. I think, like, you know, when you read about like crimes committed by women, it's very rarely in a predatory way. You know, it just seems to be an entirely different set of, you know, a mindset, a totally different
it's
thing.
It's mostly rage, I think. There's been, actually, interestingly, a proliferation this spring. When I say that, I'm thinking half a dozen, maybe a few more, of thrillers about women who are serial killers. In one case, actually triplets, where two of them were serial killers and one of them was abetting the others and then has to come to a moral junction, you know, where she has to
decide. That is such a good premise. What do you remember what that book was called? That sounds amazing.
I did an event with her and I'm not sure I can remember, but I will let you know.
Send it to me when you think of it, because I'd love to read that.
When, you know, in all of them, the common thread for the women is rage. You know, it's not a sexual thing. It's not, you know, a predatory thing. It is basically anger. You know, and I think that's probably mirrors real life, to except for the women who wind up with some, you know, and some. It's basically madness for, you know, for two people whose chemistry, when they come together, ignites into something. But if they were separate, might not ever, at least the woman might not ever have ended up committing those kinds of acts. And sometimes they get off with lesser, or, you know, they get a plea deal or some such thing. I don't know. I mean, there's all this weird stuff going on in the political world, which I think almost mirrors, what's going on presently. I mean, you know, it's this strange time. If you were a thriller writer, you could actually not make up most of the stuff happening in the world at the moment. I just don't think you could. People would laugh and say.
And you know, I think that's maybe why thrillers are getting, certainly in the Irish and UK market anyway, I would say, like, more down to earth and more realistic. And it's because there's so much absolute mayhem going on in the real world that, like, we don't have the headspace for like a Hannibal Lecter figure or something like that at the moment. Like, we can just about deal with ordinary people. So yeah, there's a lot going on. And you know, sometimes you read like cases, you know, like real life crimes and things that happened, and you just say, like, if I wrote this and I gave it to my editor, she would say, no one's going to believe this, like, this is too far-fetched. But
I agree,
that's the way the world is.
It's just like the 1930s. I used to congratulate myself that I was born in 1940 and missed the 1930s. But here we are, you know. I mean, it's like the whole world is just, you know, so many different factors, from mentioning my saguaro, which may collapse on the library here at any moment. Actually, I had a guy come by yesterday and ask if we wanted to take it down, because he was worried they're so heavy and so big that it would damage the house. And my husband and I both said, no, you know, we're going to stand with
the saguaro. You're going to stick it out.
We are going to stand with our saguaro and hope that it survives this ridiculous heat. But, you know, on every front, you know, whether it's climate or whether it's politics or whether it's, you know, it's, we're in such disarray. It's a big splintering. It's like, you know, this is sort of the course of history, is that there's this huge splintering thing. And then eventually there's kind of a synthesis and a period of calm. And then something comes along and blows it all up again. And, you know, and oddly enough, if you look for the last 500 or 600 years, this, the splintering part, it's always in the early part of the century. I mean, you can go back and look, you know, last century, it was two world wars and the Depression, and the century before, it was the Napoleonic War and Napoleon raging around Europe. And the century before, it was financial. It was the South Sea bubble bankrupting things and other things. And the century before that, it was religious wars, you know, the Catholic
Protestant. So you're saying in a few years, this will
calm down. I am hoping. Theologists kind of like live through it.
And we'll be okay for the next like 8 years.
But you know what? You make a really excellent point, which I hadn't really thought about, but it is true that there is the chaos around us in real life is in fact making fiction become more grounded and less sensational.
Well, that's my theory, because I think I've seen, you know, certainly with thrillers and on this side of the pond, that like, you know, a few years ago, you might have had one like about a serial killer who is collecting body parts to make like one person or something like that. And now it's much more like the thrillers. I'm sure those thrillers are still around, but the ones that you see doing well, the ones that you see readers responding to, are very like ordinary people. And you know, things that might actually possibly happen to you, and are not like sort of outlandish abstract fears. So yeah, I think like we just can't take anymore. Like when we sit down with a book we want to relax, we can't have the same mayhem that's on the TV screen when we turn on the news. Yeah,
actually, historical fiction has really been on the rise, in part because what's so unsettling about where we are is we don't know how it's going to come out. And, yeah. You know, and so historical fiction, at least you do know how it came out. But, you know, I say this a lot, Catherine, because the Regency novel has made a huge comeback, partly because of Bridgerton and partly, you know, because historical fiction has. And I often point out to people that while the Regency and everybody's, you know, doing cotillions in London and going to Almack and, you know, wearing fabulous clothes and the whole bit, one of the worst wars ever is raging all around them for 20 years. And it was only at the very end, in June of 2015, after 20 years, that they knew how it came out. You know, all that time. So the people were looking back and writing, you know, it was all wonderful. And
yeah.
But if you were living then, it wasn't anything like that. And you know, I mean, there's a gloss of history because.
And it's a comfort then. It's a sort of comfort, like.
Yeah.
Clean, like safe space that you can, you know, you can get lost in, and you don't have to worry about what was going on outside the windows at the time. You know?
Well, I think it explains the absolute proliferation of World War II stories. You know, I mean, a huge amount of them are not military stories. They're not about battles and all the rest. They are about women's roles primarily. But, you know, sort of ancillary, you know, the librarian or the bookkeeper or the nurse or the.
My very good friend, Hazel Gaynor, she just released a book a few weeks ago in the States called The Last Lifeboat, which primarily featured a British teacher who volunteered to be like a guardian on the sea evacuee. So a ship that took children from Britain to Canada and actually was torpedoed en route. And so the school teacher, you know, who has no real experience like parenting, she obviously has experience with children, but she's in a lifeboat with, you know, a handful of survivors, and she's trying to get them through. So I see a lot, you know, a lot of these kind of small stories within the huge scale of the war that is telling like, you know, really personal experiences through fiction, of course. Because I think like that's also comforting, like in the time of, you know, the pandemic, to know what everyone else was dealing with and how this person got through. And rather than trying to take it all in at once, which I think is very difficult for us to do, actually, to understand the scale of everyone's suffering and everything else. So it's that focus on like the individual story. So I'd highly recommend that book if you like untold stories from World War II, The Last Lifeboat.
Well, you're absolutely right that the easiest way for most people to experience the larger conflict is to focus in. And actually, your book, 56 Days, I thought is really almost the only maybe the only pandemic book that I read that not only did I enjoy it, which seemed oxymoronic, but I thought really, you know, made the experience of it come alive. And, you know, good for you that you wrote it at when most authors were in fact avoiding.
And I was at home writing that book, and then I'd go on Twitter for like a break, and I'd see everyone saying, I never want to read about COVID, I'm never going to write about COVID. And then I'd have to go back to my book and like carry on, even though I thought no one's going to read this book and everyone's going to hate me for writing it. But as it turned out, basically changed my career. And I have a lot of guilt about having had, you know, a quote unquote great pandemic because such good stuff came out of it. So,
you know, but it wasn't really about COVID. I mean,
no one had COVID.
COVID was the background to it in the same way that a war, you know, the World War II stories or whatever. So it wasn't specifically about COVID. And I think that's why it worked so well. You know, it was almost like an Agatha Christie country house murder. You know, you know, you wound up close and I think that was the first time you and I talked, wasn't it?
I think so.
Anyway, what are you working on now? Now that The Trap is out, it seems cruel to ask you in the middle of publicizing The Trap.
I know. And my sister just had a baby this morning and it's the first grandchild. So we're all just like completely discombobulated. You know, can't possibly think about work at this point. But so actually, the book I'm working on now is going to be my first thriller not set in Ireland. It's actually set in Florida.
Good Lord, why Florida?
Yeah, it still involves Irish people, but they happen to be in Florida. So last year I visited a place I had wanted to see for years and years and years. And I turned 40 last year. So I finally was like, I'm going to go. I'm going to buy myself a trip to this place. And it's Seaside, which is near Destin on the, I guess, the Panhandle. And Seaside is where The Truman Show was filmed. So if you've seen the movie The Truman Show, like that's a real place, all those beautiful cookie cutter houses. That's the town of Seaside. It was a master planned new urbanist community, I think 1981, maybe it was built. But I went there last year and I absolutely loved it. But I also thought, you know, in certain ways, a place like this could be creepy. Like if there was no one here, it was very busy when I was there, it was right after Labor Day. But if everyone cleared out, you know, you've this picture perfect town. And I just thought, you know, very few people live in the town because it's mostly vacation homes and stuff like that. So everyone is coming in from the outside. And I thought that was really interesting. And the book I'm working on is about a ghostwriter who is hired to perhaps, don't want to say too much, but tell the tale of someone who is suspected of doing something. And I needed them to go away to a place they could hide in, really, to do this without any media intrusion or anyone finding out because the project is secret. And I thought of Seaside. So it's not really Seaside. I think I've called it Sanctuary or something just so I can play around with it a bit. But yeah, I you know, I have so many American readers. I wanted to do something still Irish people. So still going to be a very Irish book, but set in Florida for a change. So yeah, working on kind of the second draft of that at the moment, but not really because my book is out and my sister just had a baby, though.
So there you are.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, you do write standalone novels. So, you know, you have the opportunity to set everyone in a different, in a new place, or you know, do some world building. Other your places, at least the books that I've read, that you have all been real. You know, the
they're all real. Yeah.
You know, so you aren't one to, I mean, it makes sense the way you seem to work, that it would be a real community, not some imaginary that you decided to construct on the Gulf Coast or something. So
I kind of feel like I have to start with reality. Like I can kind of make a few changes. Like sometimes I will, like in The Liar's Girl, I put a university in a place in Dublin where there is not a university, but everything else was Dublin as it is. And so to me, I suppose it has to kind of feel a bit real, rather than kind of, as you say, like building a fictional place from scratch. I think I'd have difficulty doing that.
I love the way every creative person has a different process.
Completely.
different, but a common element to all the crime writers that I've talked to is curiosity. There's that what if thing where the rest of us might look at this little community and think, I wonder if I'd retire there. Catherine's thinking, I wonder what people could get up to there. And I mean, no, seriously.
It
is really, you know, what differentiates readers, I mean, writers to a great degree is that they're always saying, what if? You know,
what if? Yeah. And yeah, when I'm like listening to real, like when podcasts, I'm listening to true crime podcasts or something, and there'll be like a little character, like just someone who comes in and they met the guy one time or something, and they're talking, and they're just a tiny bit of the podcast. And I'll often think, like, what if it was them? Like, what if they're just being mistaken for someone on the sidelines, but actually they're the ones who did it? And then my mind will start like going down a rabbit hole with that. So yeah, I think nearly all of crime fiction is like, what if, you know, like you just have that starting point and then you can run away with it.
I think it definitely is. You know, I do have to wonder if your book might have some effect on the actual missing people in terms of it re-inspiring investigation. You know, the true crime podcast has become so powerful and so ubiquitous. There are now thrillers being written by true crime podcasters, or where the detective is no longer a private eye, but the detective is a true crime podcaster, you know, investigating a case. And I'm wondering, you know, because your books reach a large audience, if they might actually trigger off some sort of resolution, because it sounds like, I mean, it's hard to believe that 8 women could go missing in a relatively small place without any connection. I mean, random doesn't really work, I think, in that scenario, unless you assume there's a Bermuda Triangle lurking in the Wicklow Mountains, which doesn't seem like.
I mean, it kind of terrifies me that my book would have anything to do with getting like armchair detectives involved, because I actually think we're in a place where I don't know how it is in the state. Well, actually, no, I have read stuff that it's a similar situation in the States, where armchair detectives are getting in the way of actual detection. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking of like the Idaho College student murders, and how like no one wants to wait anymore for law enforcement to do what they have to do. Like they want answers now, and they're pointing fingers at people who are innocent. And they're, you know, we had a case here in the UK a few months ago now, I'd say, Nicola Bully. She was a woman out walking and she seemingly fell into a river and drowned. And for reasons, she was kind of caught in like undergrowth. And so they brought in all these search teams and like experts and scuba divers, and they couldn't find her. And so this mystery like blew up. Like this woman went for a walk along this path. She left her phone on the bench, but she's not in the river. And people lost their goddamn minds. People were going to this tiny village where this happened. And there was people analyzing videos of her husband saying, you know, going by his body language, he's being deceptive. And they had to release very personal information about this woman to kind of get people to calm down and say, like, we're investigating this. Like, you are not a police officer. You don't understand how investigations work. Leave us do it. And things were actually getting to a stage where the town was like under siege by these people with their phones and their YouTube videos. And in the end, she was found in the river, just as, you know, the police had said. And her husband obviously was innocent of everything, of anything. And that's what I see now. Like, I see true crime enthusiasts and armchair detectives getting to a very dangerous point, where it's one thing to sit at home and look stuff up online and chat theories, you know, in a forum, that's fine. But now we have a situation where people are going out into the real world because they think they know better than the people who are actually tasked with solving the crime, which I suppose Lucy is doing too, but Lucy's sister is missing. I'm talking about like strangers who just come across the case online and then involve themselves in it. And so it would terrify me.
I agree with you, but I'm not sure you have the impulse correct there. You've already said what I think the impulse is, which is everyone wants to be the hero of his own story.
Yes.
basically hand anybody one of these and they can then start to create their own story. I see it every time we do a live event at the bookstore. People are there to hear the author and they are there to buy the book, but they're really there to get a photo so that they can they can create a story. And I say that in the nicest way.
Yeah.
You know, a signing line used to be a relatively small piece of time compared to the whole conversation. And now it can go on for hours.
People are taking pictures.
They want group photos. I won't even go into it, but there is a famous author a week or so ago, and this woman came along and brought her sister and her niece and all these other people, and she held up everybody for like 10 minutes because she wanted all these group photos and, you know, everybody interacting, and, you know, the whole thing, you know, was so yeah. that it could be. And I think that's a lot of what you're seeing going on, is not so much that these are vigilantes, is that these are people who, you know, they want to be famous, or they want to at least make
a they're statement. Trying to like put themselves into the into the event, into the story.
But I think it's very dangerous. We did do an event 2 or 3 years ago with a guy who was encouraging people to do I can't remember, but there was something that happened in Chicago. It might have been a mugging or something, or maybe it was a hit and run. But anyway, his idea was to mobilize everybody in the area that had a phone. So it'd be sort of like your cop saying, get all the CCTV. Well, we don't have all that much CCTV, but basically
we have phones.
It was turning anybody who was around with a phone into a CCTV search, hoping that, you know, if you pooled this vast number of whatever and then searched it, that there would be some useful information. And I asked him, I said, you know, what about law enforcement? You know, and no, he thought,
what about privacy?
But see, he thought that this was actually a great thing to have these kind of, you know, popular, and I think it's extremely dangerous for the reasons that you have enumerated, is that, you know, it's going to catch up a lot of innocent people. It's going to create all kinds of side effects that nobody anticipates.
And like, I do want to be clear that, like, I know these people are doing it with good intentions, but let's say the majority of them, to be kind.
I don't think so.
I'm trying to be nice to the arch detectives. With that case, like, we really, in the UK, we really saw this weird situation where instead of actually investigating the crime, the police, their time was entirely taken up with dealing with these people who were invading the town and demanding, you know, press conferences and answers, and you're not moving quick enough. And, you know, if they didn't have to deal with you, maybe there would have been an outcome sooner, you know? So it's just very, it's a very odd situation at the moment, I think, with
I think once you give everybody a phone, you've invited ramifications that are hard to imagine. Anyway, on that cheerful note, keeping in mind autographed copies, let's call up Jacob and see if there are any questions that might have arisen. We'll probably get a really maddened true crime boss. Yes.
I know. This is why I'm trying to be nice to them. They'll come for us, Barbara.
That's all right. They'll be mad at me, not at you. Right. So, Jacob, any infuriated response?
Yeah, we got lots of comments. Congratulations for being an aunt.
Thank you.
Let's see. We have one question here. This one's from Graham Hill. Catherine, you always seem so nice of a person. How do you put yourself into a mind of a madman?
I don't know what it says about me, but really easily. Like, I probably enjoyed his chapters the most. Like, I just, you know, probably because that is, of all the characters in my book, obviously the villain is the furthest from me as a real person. Or so I say. So you can get to, you know, you can get to have a bit of fun. And obviously it's all very safe. It's fiction. I'm making it up. But, you know, I really like the challenge of taking someone who has done something so abhorrent and so like, I would never do something like that. And then having the challenge of trying to make it so you go, oh, I see why he's doing it. Like, I see how he's justified this to himself. So, yeah. But all crime writers, in my experience, are super lovely. And I think Jane Casey said it's because we get all our darkness and our whatever, like, out onto the page. So there's nothing left then but niceness most of the time in reality.
Well, yeah, it certainly is an interesting question. I mean, do you find yourself having a dark side that you can kind of tap into?
Honestly, no. Yeah. Like, I'm afraid of spiders and, like, you know, my worst nightmare is having a moth in the apartment. Like, I can't deal with that. So, and I hate confrontation, and, you know, I don't like, you know, I just know, basically. I love watching, obviously, true crime and like reading crime novels and all that, but from a very safe distance, like there's nothing like that in my real life, thankfully.
Do you usually take inspiration from real life cases? How often do you read true crime or incorporate that into an actual story?
Pretty much all my books have started with a seed from real life. So Distress Signals was my very first book, and I got the idea for that having read an article called Lost at Sea by John Ronson, which was published in the Guardian magazine. And it was about a woman who had disappeared from a Disney cruise ship. But what actually caught me was a mention of, it was just like a paragraph, the International Cruise Victims Organization. And I've never been on a cruise, still haven't been on a cruise, will never go, Barbara, sorry, but hey, cruises. After all the research I did, never going on one. But I was like, victims of what? Like, I don't understand what bad things can happen on a cruise. And I started Googling and I found out like all this, essentially that when you go on a cruise, you are going on vacation to a country with no police, effectively. Because all the security is like working for the cruise company and there's no real like cops on there and stuff like that. So that's what led me to Distress Signals. Rewind came from a post-secret image that I saw, which is like a project where people send their deepest, darkest secrets to this man who puts them on the internet and anonymously. And the secret was a picture of a bedroom and it said, I trade hidden sex videos with other Airbnb hosts. And I just thought, thank God I don't stay in Airbnbs. And second of all, what if you were doing that and you got more than you bargained for? What if you captured a murder? So it's not so much that like I consume a lot of true crime and then I go, oh, I want to write a fictional version of that case. It's more that like something I come across in a magazine article or whatever leads me to the idea. The only time it was more than that was The Nothing Man. Because I read I'll Be Gone in the Dark just a week after James D'Angelo or Joe D'Angelo was arrested and identified. And I just couldn't get it out of my head. Had he read that book? Had he read Michelle McNamara's book? And if so, how did he feel about it? And we were kind of talking about this at the top that like fiction is kind of a way to solve a mystery that real life cannot do for you. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write a fake true crime memoir that I've made up and the killer's reaction to it as he reads. And so that's where The Nothing Man came from. But that's probably the one that has most real life inspiration, even though I hate that word when we're talking about terrible things, but yeah.
Okay, great. Pat asks, do you have any favorite authors, true crime or within the same genre that you write in?
So these days, like I always used to say, Michael Connelly was my, well, we have talked about this with Barbara before, that he's my favorite crime writer. But recently, like in recent years, I find myself drawn to individual books a lot more than writers with late, because I feel like time is so short and I'm trying to read as widely as I can that, you know, unless it's something that I really care about, I don't really, you know, stick with the same author every time. So I think I've just read a great book. It's true crime, but it's true crime with a difference, I would say. And it's A Thread of Violence by Mark O'Connell. So it's about Malcolm MacArthur, who was a really famous double murderer here in Ireland. And it sort of asks the question, like we were kind of talking about this, Barbara, like what kind of a man commits murder? Like who is he outside of the act of murder? And it's a really, really incredibly well-written and really interesting book that makes you rethink, I think, your attitude towards true crime. And I'd highly, highly recommend it. And in terms of crime fiction, I think the best crime novel or in that genre that I, which has a touch of true crime to it, that I've read this year, it's not out until next month, but Jessica Knoll's new novel, Bright Young Women, is amazing. And it's inspired, again, we need a better word, but inspired by Ted Bundy's sorority murders. And what she does is she basically puts fictional characters into that event and she completely reclaims the story for the women involved. And it is extraordinary. I just thought it just blew me away. It was amazing.
I have to ask you, because I haven't read it yet. Have you read Liz Nugent's new book, Strange Sally Diamond?
Yeah. Yeah, read it months ago.
I thought you might have. It looks extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's like possibly her best. It was number one here in Ireland for 9 weeks.
Was it?
Yeah, so did amazingly well. And I think it's like the most Liz Nugent novel that Liz has written, if that makes sense. And it's excellent. I would also highly recommend that. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it would be a tremendous challenge to an author to write that character.
Oh yeah.
I noticed a review I looked at earlier today that said at the end, despite all the weirdness, the character is strangely sympathetic. So I'm going to be interested to see if
I think Liz specializes in that. Like Liz doesn't make things easy for herself. And she always like sets herself an incredible challenge. But I think one of her one of her unique skills is that she does write these like horrific characters. Although I think Sally is I would be more fond of Sally than most of Liz's characters in the past. But she does make them incredibly sympathetic because, as we said, we're all the heroes of our own lives.
Indeed. Right. Anything else, Jacob?
That's it.
Great.
Well, Catherine, since you probably want to go off and if not see the grandbaby.
I can't see him yet, but I can go look at photos. I'll see him over the weekend. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your second appearance for discussing this book. Once again, I apologize to those of you who showed up last week and then it didn't happen, but here we are having a great time. The Trap. We should have autographed copies coming up soon. And one of my dreams is to get Catherine to actually come to Arizona.
One day when it's not hot, I will go.
We're going to have to find her a publication date in like January, but we'll figure it out.
We'll do it.
Thank you all very much for joining us. Thank you very much, Catherine, for spending time with us. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.